Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. It seems like it's been a very rough weekend when this cold front is coming across the U.S., and there were a lot of unexpected tornadoes. And we always talk about the weather in the beginning of the show because we like to say, you know, what's going on around you and how does that connect with today's show? So we talk about botanicals today and the weather, and it's stormy. And it tends to rip out all the vegetation, displaces people, it displaces their environment and their memories. But they always seem to go to another place, resettle, and regain all that they've had in a different area. I can say with Hurricane Katrina we had here, all the vegetation was ripped up. People moved to different areas. But, you know, the grass still grew. The flowers still came through. People still started to put down their roots with their trees and nature, and people went on. So today, we're going to be talking about botanicals, how they've been around forever. They've been around for centuries and centuries, and it's at different times they've been medicine, they've been food, they've been bases for pharmaceutical drugs, but at times they've just been something that people would just look at on the ground and admire, and at other times they can't wait to get rid of them with pesticides. So botanicals have really had a full realm of being tossed and turned and moved around to different areas and different names. And it's been a really different topic where a lot of people don't even know what botanical means. Today when we talk about botanicals, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Kim Engard. She is a naturopathic physician in Arizona, and she has over 30 years of being an herbalist, so she'll be happy to share all of her background about botanicals and plants, parts of plants, why they're important, where they've been in the centuries, and how we can relish all of that information now to really help our health to get better. I don't know if you've read on the news today. Today is Monday. But it said, superbugs, antibiotics are not going to be working soon. And you think, okay, so what are you going to do about it? Well, that's the only topic they talked about in the article. They didn't talk about what they're going to do about it. So botanicals may be our next line of therapy for being able to look at bacterias and viruses and all different things that are making us sick. So today I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Kim Engard, and she'll be more than happy to take our calls. Also, if you have a call, you can call in at 424-258-9318, and please do push 1 if you'd like to ask a question on the air. So Dr. Kim, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Jeanette. I'm looking forward to talking to you today.
So do you connect maybe what I was saying? You know, plants have been around forever, but they've gone through so many different transitions and, you know, in the news, out of the news, helping people, not helping people, you know, getting ripped up from the environment and still coming through. They seem to be, you know, just always able to survive.
Yeah, they have that's very true. I think that's a really good point in light of the storms and the changes in worldwide weather, really. Definitely we've seen it in the Midwest and throughout the United States over the last few years, that people are getting displaced. And often it's interesting because I think that when there is disaster and when people do need to be or are uprooted, maybe they don't want to be or need to be, but they end up uprooted like the plants, they are pretty versatile and able to, you know, find a new way. And plants and humans definitely have a big connection. You know, we rely on them and they rely on us in a lot of ways. You know, if we think about just the fact that plants use carbon dioxide that we breathe out every day, and we use the oxygen that they create with photosynthesis. We really are, you know, in need of their everyday presence to be able to live on the planet. And we, like the plants, can be uprooted and find a new way together. And that's really important to remember, that connection. I think that's a connection that I'd like to see people reconnect with, and I know you do, in terms of health, but also just in terms of our connection to the planet and our need to care for those plants and realize that we need them to survive.
You know, all the time you'll see photos after disasters of a little tiny flower coming through, and people always emphasize on that picture. You know, but you also look at people and they've been really sick, and you always take a picture of how they're feeling better. We're always interested in how you can go through from not feeling well or having something happen to you devastating, and then you always seem to flourish afterwards. And that's so important. I mean, even if it's just a flower when you're in the hospital brought to you, you know, will bring a smile to your face.
Right.
So they have so much folklore behind them. I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, you've been an herbalist for, you know, over, you said 30 years. So if you can tell us, you know, start back from the beginning, your thoughts about plants, that would be great.
Yeah, it seems like almost as far back as I can remember, I just had a real interest in working and learning about plants, especially medicinal plants. I really, you know, I was thinking about this before the show, just how that all started for me. And I would say when I was an early teen, I just started studying herbal medicine. I didn't really have a family member or someone to follow in my immediate area, but I started studying on my own. And by the time I was 18, I started apprenticing at an herb store with an herbalist, and kind of learned in the old way that herbal medicine got its traditions, which is apprenticeships. And the beauty of that is just that you obviously are able to learn from an individual and learn about their experience, but you actually get a lot of hands-on in that way too. And that was a path that really was how I started in natural medicine. It was challenging, to tell you the truth, because that long ago, there were certainly people you could find study with if you looked hard enough, and opportunities, which I did find. But there weren't so many schools around, which we even have now. We certainly have our naturopathic schools, which teach herbal medicine because it's an important healing medicine. But we do have a lot of herb schools and all around the country that have, you know, really good programs as well. But back then, there weren't a lot of those. And I kind of had to sort of create a path for myself. It was a little bit challenging. And I certainly, as those of us have been doing healing medicine for a long time, got a lot of negative feedback about this plant or that plant could really hurt you, you know. And it's kind of funny looking back on that, because as you mentioned, botanical medicine or herbal medicine obviously has been with us as long as we've probably been on the planet. We can look back at Hippocrates and, you know, Paracelsus and really ancient philosophers talking about plants, you know, in ancient societies, and certainly in our spiritual traditions like the Bible, plants are mentioned throughout the Bible and other spiritual books and in other religions too. That's really how I got into healing arts, and as I learned more about plants, it's just interesting because even after 30 years, I'm always learning more and more every day. But I think that just getting started for people individually, you know, just having a garden or introducing themselves to a particular herb that sounds good to them, maybe it's just a tea or something they use in their food, and just learning a little bit more about that is one way to become educated and just start to see how those plants might matter in your life. You mentioned the flower as an important symbol of hope, I think, is kind of what I got from what you're saying. And it certainly is, you know, brightens our day. And certainly oils from those flowers, which a lot of essential oils are made from flowers, certainly uplift our spirits. as well as can be medicine, right? And so I think that we really do rely and use plants in our everyday life, and we may have, as people on the planet, I mean, technology is a great gift to be able to communicate, for us to be able to talk on the radio today in this way that we do it here on the blog radio, is an amazing thing, but it also removes us from our natural environment, you know, and it's almost like, and this is true for me too, having a busy practice, that I actually have to make time to go out and be with the plants, you know, because that's really the best way for me to learn about them and be able to share that with other people.
I know in my past I had grown up in Pennsylvania, and in the 50s and 60s, there was a little talk about plants, not very much really. But in the 70s and 80s when I was there, we had nettles in the backyard. It grew wild. And, you know, we would notice different types of plants in different areas and how they were able to help people. The nettles, it was funny that it was at our house and growing wild when all of my kids had asthma, which nettles is something mm-hmm. that you would potentially use for that. So I would always tend to say to people, sometimes the things that bother you, you may look outside your door first and find out what plants are there. And then when I lived in Arizona, you know, the aloe was right outside the front door. Or when I lived in California, we had California poppies outside the door, you know, or when we lived in Florida, mm-hmm. we had another plant outside the door. There was always something that was outside the door that always seemed to relate to something we may have needed at one time or another. So it's not really that you're looking for these plants because, and you have to travel to some far-off forest where they're planting them all over the place. Usually what you need at that time might be just right outside your door. Have you found that, too, in different areas you've lived?
Absolutely. And I think it's a really important point, you know, that you really don't have to go very far. Something like nettles or some other what other farmers and other people might consider weeds, right? Nettles has, you know, obviously a thistle, and it's kind of an annoying plant to harvest. Or if you were a farmer, if you had a lot of nettles growing on your farmland, it would be kind of annoying. I remember I had an herbalist friend of mine in Colorado, where I'm lived for many, many years and practiced herbal medicine there. And she was actually growing nettles for me to use with my herb company and making products and stuff. And she had a farmer right next to her, and it was in rural Colorado, and he was complaining that her nettles were coming on. Her noxious weeds were invading his farmland,
right.
Which you can understand if you've been around nettles and they're stingy and they hurt when you scratch up against them, that they can be annoying, but that noxious weed was an amazing medicine. And it really, in the tradition of herbs as well, not only are they easily accessible, right, in your local environment, but they also teach us about something about our environment. You know, it's a known fact that certain plants will grow in areas where there are certain problems. For instance, plants growing in the jungle where there's a lot of malaria and that sort of thing, like cinchona bark, for instance, is, you know, useful against fevers and malaria, and it grows in an area that's relative to where that is a big problem. And animals know this. You know, they'll go for plants for problems in an area. They'll go and instinctively find those plants. Children, to some degree, do that too. And you may have had that experience where they know they want some mint when their tummy doesn't feel good, if that's something they're familiar with. But we kind of forget that, you know, as adults sometimes. There's so many things that we get bogged down about and we're busy with, and we kind of forget the simple things that can help us feel better, you know, even plants right outside our door. But that knowledge is always there for us. It's almost like the plants are telling us, hey, remember me? I'm right here.
Right.
Come visit me. I'm right outside your door.
I think sometimes, though, we as people have gone in and changed the local plants, or, you know, just tried to get them out of there and brought in other things that were not native to that area. I can always remember, though, I lived in an area one time, and it was kind of like a homeowner's thing. You weren't allowed to have dandelions in your yard. You know how that goes, right? Mm-hmm. But dandelions were the best thing for your dogs to run in so they wouldn't bring the fleas in the house. You know, and it was like, mm-hmm. are you really kidding me? You know, we're going to have to put pesticides down. And, of course, you're not going to let your dog run in the pesticides, so you may as well have your dandelions in your backyard. But it was always a constant mm-hmm. fight. And when it rained, you would see all the pesticides going down the gutter, you know, from everybody's lawn. So we try to really eradicate those things that are really helping us, not even thinking about how it might be able to keep you from exposure to other toxins or pesticides that you really don't need. You know, because then you have people saying, oh, well, I need to give something to the dog. I need to put something on the grass. I need to this, I need to that. Where if they just left everything alone, all would be well.
Right. And that's definitely a big issue everywhere. We see it in Arizona a lot because, you know, some of our native plants, not that they aren't beautiful in their season, but they're prickly and pokey, and they're not something you may want in your front yard if you're living in a housing community in suburbia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of that going on in terms of people just not being connected to their environment, you know. There's plants that I know people grow here as landscape plants, like encelia and other plants, which is deer vetch. It's a very pretty yellow-flowered plant. And they have no concept that that's a plant that they could use for breathing problems and asthma and nerve pain, actually, and things that the Native Americans used it for. And certainly the pesticide issue is just creates more disconnect, right? It creates problems for the plants. It creates problems for us. And I know any good gardener, you know, once they work with plants for a while, they realize that there are certain insects that certain plants can draw to them that will actually protect other plants and prevent bug problems, right? All those kinds of things. But I think when we have that problem of not really being part of our environment, we just feel like it's not necessary to really think too much about it, you know? It's that knowledge that just kind of gets lost. And that's kind of one of my focuses now in my career is to really help reach out to people and make that connection, help them remember their connection to the planet and how really important it is that not only they can use things locally and encourage growth of certain plants that will help them in their neighborhood, in their environment, et cetera, but that they realize it's a necessity. It's a necessity for the future of the planet, for our health. You mentioned earlier that, you know, the superbug, the next big superbug, we won't have the antibiotics necessary to treat that. And how scary a thought that is to people, I'm sure. And what a lot of people probably don't know, you know, maybe people in our profession know and herbalists, but a lot of knowledge that was known before, you know, thousands and thousands of years of herbal medicine history, is that there are plants, and there's been scientific studies on them to prove this. And, you know, I certainly did a lot of that teaching at the med school and researching all that to be able to teach the naturopathic doctors about that, that there are plants that really will work against some of these really major superbugs. Because plants have a connection to us. There's genetic studies going on right now that show our genetic code, our DNA, and plants are mirrors to each other. You know, just like that carbon dioxide and oxygen issue, you know, that they're producing things we need to breathe and we're producing things they need. And that as these superbugs, as we know, viruses mutate, you know, we get a different flu shot every year because the viruses change, right? And even if it's the same virus, it's different because it's trying to survive and it changes so it can continue to live on the planet too. Plants have the ability to use a number of different parts of them, as we call constituents, active parts, that work at helping our own immune systems and our own bodies fight these things. And it almost like educates our immune system on what it needs to do. And certainly there are plants that are almost drug-like where they'll go in and actually do one action. But that's the beauty of plants, is that they have more than one action. And I think that's really important for people to understand that too, that it's not just one action that it does, you know, whereas unfortunately in drug medicine we get limited, you know. We've got a drug that's created to do one thing, and then if a virus comes around that doesn't act in that way, then that antibiotic on a bacteria is not going to be effective. Or that flu inoculation is not going to be, that vaccine is not going to be effective. We need to try to make a new one. And I notice when I treat, I notice treating viruses like the swine flu that's been out going on its fifth year, I do a lot of work with that in my practice in virology and treating viruses and things like that. And you see the virus start to change, and I change the herbs in the formula, but it still works. But I have to really watch what the virus is doing and how it creates symptoms in each patient. So there is a knowledge and there's a wisdom with plants. And even though we can use them, something like peppermint to soothe an upset stomach, or you know, they can be simple uses that can help us every day. Plants also have the ability to do really strong things too. You know, I've successfully treated MRSA with plants a number of times, and it's important to know that plants can do these things for us.
I always think about the Indians and on the reservations in Arizona, how they have such a high rate of diabetes, yet the aloe and the paddle cactus are right outside their door, and they wouldn't even think of going back to their native plants to be able to take care of it when they're still looking outside themselves for a reason or why they have it and to fix it instead of going backwards and learning about how they didn't have it in the past, you know, with the fast food, and then they're looking for drugs and they don't really, you know, have that connection. I know there were a lot of studies out that they were starting to look at that, but I'm not sure where that progress has been made. But that is very important to definitely look outside your door and see what plants are out there.
Absolutely, and it's about reconnecting. I mean, you brought up the Indian reservations. For instance, the Pima Indians here, Salt River Reservation here right near Phoenix, has the highest diabetes amongst all the tribes in the United States. And looking at their history in terms of their native diet, they relied on prickly pear and other forms of native foods that had a natural control over blood sugar. And when they went off those foods and started eating, you know, white flour, white bread, all that kind of stuff that is just not part of their natural diet, they get sicker than European descent people, right? Because their bodies are used to those foods for centuries and centuries. And that is something that I know there are a number of naturopathic physicians and other doctors. I know Dr. Bob Waters, who is a PhD. He works in genetics, and he's a very learned man in this field. He's done a lot of work in studying the tribe, especially the Pimas, and understanding how they're being affected by those foods. And so there is a lot of effort in the Native American community, amongst the Native Americans as well, to help reconnect, right, with not only their language, that a lot of people, you know, definitely the Navajos have and other tribes have not everyone, you know, people don't know their native language, but also their foods, right, and their traditions, and the knowledge that goes with that. So you're absolutely right. There's that disconnect there. But I think there's progress being made there as well. You know, there really is a big push to, I know a number of naturopathic physicians who are working on the reservations, and I know of their experience, and what they've told me, too, is that work entirely on the res, on reservation projects for health, that they get some Native Americans who are very comfortable with working with the herbs and working, talking about Native foods because they heard it from their grandparents, from their elders. Even if they don't know how to do it, they're open to that because it's part of their tradition. They know it's part of their tradition. And so there is an interest, but you're right that disconnect with not only the Native people but with all of us is almost like a disease, you know, that we really need to find a cure for, which is basically just reconnecting with our environment. It's really what it comes down to. And understanding that we're as much of the environment as the environment relies on us. That's the biggest thing, you know. It's kind of like when you get, for instance, we have a slot canyon on a property in southern Utah, and we have that slot canyon was created where the water flows down in a flood stage because people were driving ATVs on it over and over and over again, and it created a weakness in the sand there. And next thing you know, we've got water coming down, rushing down, torrents of water, 15 feet of water in a flood, right? And like other places in the country, we've had really intense weather, right, in the last few years, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show with the tornadoes. And just this year, we now have had the 1,000-year flood, which a couple right. years ago it was the 100-year flood. And the interesting thing is I've been trying to talk with some of the BLM and some of land management about coming up with some native species that we could plant along the sides of the slot canyon so that it won't keep spreading, right? Because as you said before, these plants have been pulled out and other species have been put in, and this is true even in rural areas where there's been farming and cattle raising, right, which this land along the Puyallup River was definitely, that was going on from the 1800s. And so some of these native species that really would protect this washout of the soil is not really growing like it normally would, you know. There's an interesting story. My father-in-law, who's he's going on 91 this year, and very sharp-minded man. We were up on the property, and he was looking at this prickly stuff, right? And you know, it's called. He goes, "Oh, we used to call that Russian thistle in the Second World War, because he was fighting in the Second World War." And he said they brought that over during the war because they wanted to see if they could make some kind of explosive out of it, because it's very combustible, right? And now this stuff is growing all over, right? This is the tumbleweeds. And right. And it does have, you know, combustible nature to it, but it's an invasive species, you know, and it's everywhere. And the interesting thing is the more you dig up the earth, the more that stuff grows, right? So if you leave an environment alone, doesn't spread, and some of the native plants come back.
Well, you know, we also talk about getting back to botanicals and native plants in our area, but we also talk about a plant-based diet. And when we talk about a plant-based diet, that's eating things that grow outside that are normal to your area. I know when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, we ate whatever the farmers had in their area. We didn't get produce from a grocery store at that time. So, you know, looking at, we went to plants for food a long time ago, and now we're trying to go back to plants for food again, and we still haven't recognized that plants as medicine is something we need to go back to next. I know when you go to the doctor, he'll never ask you, what kind of botanicals are you taking? Are you taking anything? What drugs are you taking? And you'll start telling him, and he'll say, no, the ones I gave you a prescription for. That's their only concern. Mm-hmm. When they don't really recognize that those drugs have had to have some source way back when of a botanical. Because what many yeah. drugs are is they've taken a compound from a plant, and that is the drug.
Yeah, you know, before the show I was thinking about something I used to mention in talks in the past, and it's perfectly relevant to what you just said, is the history of aspirin, for instance, you know, which everybody's familiar with aspirin, of course, and a lot of people take it every day to keep their blood thin, like a baby aspirin, to prevent a heart attack. And, you know, that was formulated in the mid-1800s off of white willow bark. And willow bark, the willow family plants, have salicylates in them, and that's basically the backbone of aspirin and what it is and how it creates not only a blood thinning effect but an anti-pain effect. And the history of white willow bark, you know, goes back thousands of years, back to the Greek time and even mentioned in ancient Egypt. being used for pain and blood thinning and antiplatelet and all that kind of stuff. The beauty of plants, again, is that, like you said, there may be a constituent like salicylic acid or some form of that in a plant, meadow sweet has it as well, that creates this reaction, but there are other parts of the plant that protect us. And I know that a lot of people think of aspirin, they say, well, it upsets my stomach, or I shouldn't be taking, you know, the large dose aspirin. My doctor says to take the 81 milligrams of baby aspirin from, you know, every day as a preventative for a clot. And why? Well, because part of the reason is that that acid affects your digestion, it irritates your stomach, it can cause ulcers. And the beauty of a plant like white willow bark is that it has other gums and sugars and things in it to protect the gut, right? And we call it an astringent, so it actually helps tonify the gut, and we use astringents to prevent ulcers. So there's a beauty of that plant in saying it has this ability to prevent pain, right, and inflammation like something like aspirin does, but it also protects our bodies. It does more just that one action. And that really is the beauty of the plants and how they're really made for us, ultimately. You know, they work with our bodies very efficiently to do that. And some of that wise folk medicine, you know, is still applicable today. It doesn't mean that it's not as strong. It doesn't mean it doesn't work as well. I think that's something that people have been led to believe, that plants as medicine, you know, that they're mild. You know, you use them if you want to relax a little bit. You drink a little, you know, sleep tea or something. Or if you, you know, you have a little upset stomach, you take something for that with a plant, mint or ginger. And yes, that's true. But plants have a much bigger action and very strong action, even against really powerful and strong illnesses and diseases. And the other thing that people, you know, should be aware of, I think, too, is that you can't patent a plant. And that's
right.
Really the bottom line a lot of times when it comes to drug medicine. You know, you can't patent an herb. An herb is an herb. It's actually considered a food product, you know, by the FDA. And, you know, and there are certain herbs that are limited use that you need to be certified professional to use because they're very strong and perhaps could be dangerous in the wrong hands. And so not all herbs are, I think, useful for everyone over the counter without more knowledge. That's true. But without being able to patent something, you can't make a lot of money on it. And so,
yeah.
You know, That's a fact, and certainly making drug medicine out of plants to isolate a certain part of that plant to make it stronger was part of why the pharmaceutical industry was developed. Absolutely, you know, it wasn't all just about income, but certainly the fact that you can't patent an herb now is a big player, unfortunately. And it's good for the herbs, you can't patent them, I'm sure. But you may be able to control what kind of seeds you get, right, or how toxic those plants are. Like you mentioned dandelion, which, you know, if anyone drives around the United States, you'll see in certain areas dandelion growing on the side of the road, right? So we always want to be wary about where's that plant growing and how exposed it's been to pesticides and other environmental toxins, even exhaust from cars and things like that.
We've also cautioned people on the show. We've said, you know, granted, if you know plants are in your yard or you're growing them because you like them or you believe that they are a good medicine to have in your yard, it's not something where you just go out and pick it and make your own medicine either, because I always use the example, if we look at the oak tree, the leaves, the stems, the buds, the bark, the root, and the seeds have all different constituents for all different varying reasons. It's not like when we talk about botanical medicines, we say, just hack off a stem, throw it in a bottle, and you're good to go. That's, you know, an oak botanical medicine. That's not really true. So we do caution people, botanical medicine is not something that you just dabble in to be able to create your own medications if you don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a good place to start, you know, is for people to look at teas, you know, herbs that are good in teas. And a lot of times, some of, not always, but like you said, some types of constituents in plants are not what we call water-soluble. So if you extracted it in alcohol, you made a stronger medicine out of it, you may get some constituents that are stronger and may have some negative side effects. But certainly taking some mint, you know, that you know is not, is pesticide-free, you grew it in your garden, or even some red clover or other plants like that, rose hips or something that you know is... traditionally chamomile, for instance, you know, that you know is a traditional tea and it's used for this and that, and just kind of working with some of the safer plants is fine. But certainly when we get into other parts of a plant, I think that's an important conversation to have, because tradition shows us a lot too. And I know when I teach this medical students, we don't always look at it this way, but over time, some of the really well-known herbs that we use for medicine, like echinacea, for instance, right? We talk about the root all the time. And part of the reason we talk about the root isn't always because that's the strongest part. A lot of times it comes from how that plant was stored and when it was used and got a lot of at least modern history, meaning, you know, in our country's time, 1800s, early 1900s. And there was storage issues, too, for certain plants. And leaves and flowers, really, as long as they're safe to use, they should be used closer to fresh, if possible. But roots last a little bit longer. And so some plants that were really good medicines, like echinacea, for instance, we talk all about, we have a lot of knowledge about what the root does. And now we're finding that there's actually some benefits with the upper portion of the plant, with the flower and the leaf. It's just traditionally that root was able to last for a long time, and people tend to use those roots because they did last through a winter. And the different parts of the plant is very important because, like you said, you mentioned nettles before. Mm-hmm. The leaf of the nettles is very different constituent-wise than its root, and the root really isn't an allergy part of the plant. We know that the leaf part is really good for asthma and allergies. But the root tends to have some constituents in it that helps with hormonal balance, especially in men. And it is anti-inflammatory, but it works along a little different pathway. And so, yeah, there's different parts of plants that may have very different actions on the body. And there's obviously a massive amount of knowledge, right, and history to using plants as medicine. So it does take a little more investigation and consulting with someone who knows these things. You know, you brought up that doctors will often say, you know, what are you taking? And then when people list like an herb or something, they're like, well, I just mean your medication. The other side of that, too, is what I've seen a lot with surgeons and such, that, and I say this because I have a lot of patients that use in post-surgery protocols with me and things like that, that they... doctors will say, just go off everything, or the nurse who they're talking to prior to surgery or procedure will say, well, just don't take anything, don't take any of your supplements. And, right. And patients will often say to me, well, why do they do that? You know, and it's like, well, because they're not trained in the knowledge of knowing what those herbs are you're taking, like what they actually do. So it's easier just to say stop it all than to stop it, only stop some of it if you don't. You know, so what a lot of people come to me, and sometimes I get referrals for it. Well, they'll say, "Hey, I'm on these things, and I'm gonna have this, or I'm gonna start this other medication. What is safe and what's not safe?" You know, and many times I'll actually talk to the surgeon, I'll talk to the physician, and say, "Look, this is my background as a naturopathic doctor and doing botanicals for this long, and I know what that herb is gonna do with surgery or anesthesia, and I can." So there are professionals out there that people can consult. Sold to us, you know, herbalists, naturopathic doctors that have studied botanicals, because all of us as naturopaths have learned that in school, and many choose to learn more after they graduate about botanical medicine or herbal medicine. But you're right, there's a lot of information out there, and there's a lot of wrong information on the internet too. So I would caution people to, you know, there's a lot of great information, a lot of great websites out there with herbal information that is very accurate. There's a lot of studies, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of studies on a lot of plants. that are very clear. But what do you do with all that information? Well, find someone who's been educated and can give you the information you need, just like you go to a doctor to get medication. And here in Arizona, as naturopathic doctors, we have an incredibly huge scope to prescribe medication. You know, we do almost a full pharmacy, drug medicine as well as herbs and other types of natural medicine. Not that I choose to prescribe drugs. I very rarely ever do that. Most of the time, it helps me get people off drugs because you need to kind of understand the drug to be able to find an alternative for it and to help take that person off of it. But we do have professionals, naturopathic doctors, et cetera, that can help people make sense of all this information and find the best and natural way to help heal their bodies. And that's really important.
So, Dr. Kim, do you have products yourself, or are you using specific products? I know if you can give us a little information, I know you have some website also that listeners will be able to check out and find out more information.
Yeah, I've actually had my botanical medicine company, Wildwoods Botanicals, since 1995. And I'm actually in a process of revitalizing that business right now for retail use. I've just been doing wholesale for a number of years now. It's been about 12 years. But I'm actually redesigning the website right now. There is a website, and it's on the link on your page there, for my practice, Wildwoods Healing Arts, but also for Wildwoods Botanicals. In the next month or two, I will have the new website up with information about the plants, the retail products that Wildwoods Botanicals has been making, and that information will be up there within the next month or so. So it's kind of an exciting time. I'm looking to try to create more educational options for people and products as well. You know, so I've basically been functioning with the business to help support practitioners, so naturopathic doctors and other people with the products. And so, for instance, in my practice, I actually have hundreds of herbal medicines in my pharmacy, my natural pharmacy, to use with patients. And most of those extracts are made by the botanical company, the Wildwoods Botanicals, but and teas and other products too. But I will be expanding that to retail in the near future. So it's kind of exciting for us here at Wildwoods.
Great. And also, if anybody would like to get in touch with you, they can. You do have a contact us page on your website. I did see it. And it's really important to the listeners to be able to look and find good botanicals, because sometimes when you think about botanicals as flowers or plants or trees or branches or roots, and you go to a large chain grocery store or something and pick up something off of the shelf, generally, well, more often than not these days it's starting to seem, is that there's very little active compound in there that will even be able to help you. Or if it does, you could really use a different form. Let's say there's a capsule there or a tablet there, when a tincture might be something that's better for you, and it might be able to be a little bit stronger so you can have more favorable results quicker. And with so there's a lot of questions and controversy about what is a good type botanical, what's not. So we have a few minutes left. If you could just speak to about tinctures and, you know, and how they come in what forms and what your thoughts are on. I mean, I know so many people that say, I'll go to the place down the corner, or I know somebody, you know, they've got this multi-level thing, I'm just going to pick them up there. And you wonder, and they say, oh, well, that never works. Well, of course it doesn't work, you know, because you got the wrong form of it.
Yeah, I have an interesting short story about that. Many years ago when I first had my herb business in the mid-90s, I had a woman come in who actually worked down the street from where my store was, and she said, I'm starting to get a migraine, and I need something really quickly. And she was in a really big rush, you know. And I said, oh, well, I have some Feverfew capsules right here. Why don't I give you some of those? And I had them in bulk, you know, and they were really fresh. Mm-hmm. So that plant, feverfew, is the leaf and aerial portion, the upper portion of the plant. And as a leaf, you know, it doesn't last very long, right? And you want it as close to fresh, maybe not fresh, but freshly dried as possible, because some of the constituents, some of the things in that plant that are very anti-inflammatory, for instance, for a migraine, that if that capsule's old, it's not going to work anymore, right? So
right.
I knew that those capsules were fresh because I had put the herb in there. I knew that they were really fresh, and I rotated them. And I said, well, here, why don't I just give you some of these? And she said, oh, what is it? I said, well, this is feverfew. She said, well, I tried that. I don't know if it's going to work. It didn't work for me before. And I said, where'd you get it? And she said, oh, I got it at the big container store, you know, up on the highway. And I said, try these because this is really fresh. I didn't go into a long explanation of it because she was in a bad way with her migraine coming on. And she said, well, I'll let you know. And she ran out. She had to go back to her place of business. Well, I didn't see her for a day or so. And then a day or so later, I was in a fairly small town. I ran into her again, and I said, what happened? And she goes, oh, my gosh, I forgot to tell you. It worked great. She's like, that must have been really fresh because it worked totally differently than my experience with those tablets I took of the fever food from the big store. And, you know, there's a perfect example of you really need to know where you're getting your products from and get that from a local herbalist or a store where you know that the herbs are going to be active, that they're not going to be sitting on a shelf for a long period, and that you know what you're getting. That's absolutely true. There are a couple websites of companies that are in some of them, I don't mean companies in terms of buying product from, but companies that are supporting herbal medicine like United Plant Savers or the American Herbalist Guild, where they do have links to ethically harvested plants that are available, and companies that are within certain, you know, they're functioning to support plants and not eradicate them. You know, especially in the United States, we've had problems with American ginseng, for instance, which is kind of from your neck of the woods, I mean the southeast part of the country, where there's been so much over-harvesting of that plant and many others too, that they're endangered plants now because there is a market, there's a commodity for them, and people are going out into the woods and harvesting it and unfortunately depleted the amount of American ginseng that's available. And some nonprofits like United Plant Savers, for instance, was created to help protect those plants and to encourage people to grow them and harvest them wisely and to educate the public on where to get plants that are safe and you're not a plant that is a problem. I remember I had a lady come in many years ago in my store in Colorado with some American ginseng, and I said to her, so where'd you get this? And she was from the South, and she was traveling through, and she wouldn't tell me, and then she, and I said, so, you know, you're not growing it, you went and harvested this, and I had a long conversation, well, it was probably too long for her, the conversation, but about, you know, hey, you know, we need to be careful about that, you know, and I didn't want to buy the plants from her because I didn't want to support that. So, yeah, the point going back to what you said about the quality and what would be safe, you know, many plants, some plants, It's a long conversation, but the short of it is that some plants you do need an extract to get these constituents that are medicinally available, you know, that are medicines out of the plant. They're not necessarily water-soluble, meaning that if you put it in a tea, you may not get the full action. And that is true with some plants. So you'll find that certain types of medicines are always in an extract form. If you went to a health food store, an herb store, you could see that certain ones are always in a cough syrup base or an extract base. And then we have other plants like the feverfew, for instance, which you can use in an extract as well. But if you do use a capsule of the leaves, you just want to be careful. They have started a number of companies that are making herb formulas now. Have started making liquid extracts in a capsule where they actually make an extraction of the plant. It's stable for a number of years, and many extracts are usually stable 3 to 5 years once they're made, if they're made correctly. And they're putting it into like a gel cap so that someone could take it as easily as a capsule, but the quality or the effectiveness of the plant holds its value over a little bit longer period of time. And sometimes that's not a bad thing. Depends on what it is, right? Again, some of these questions, it's good to ask someone who's familiar with plants professionally, is working with botanicals and can kind of answer these questions for you. And there are many people, you know, where you could go to a local community store, herb store, whatever, where you can get some good knowledge and know where those plants are coming from. I think that's really the answer to this, because certainly supplements and botanicals, herbs, are becoming more widely available, even in the big consignment stores and that sort of the big container stores, excuse me. But the quality is not the same, and you really hit right. a really important point.
Yeah,
you
want to
know
when,
where those plants came from.
When you're getting a tea that's been mass-produced and you're saying it has chamomile in it, you sometimes can brew that, and you're like, oh, I don't really notice it, and you give up on that, when really we're saying don't mm-hmm. give up on it, because chances are there's probably so very little in there that it really didn't have any effect anyway. We have about 5 minutes left. I was wondering if you could give us just a few tips. We are coming up on the cold and flu season, of maybe 2 or 3 herbs to just maybe have in the house. I know elderberry is always keen, but if you could give us maybe mm-hmm. 2 or 3 others, it would be great.
Yeah. You know, with the latest flu bug that's been going around, I said the swine flu, the H3N2, that was the latest CDC name they gave it. It's still around this year, and we saw here in Arizona that it was around all summer, actually. And the kids go back to school a little earlier here in August, and there was another flare of it, and it has kind of like a stomach flu component to it. Another herb that seems to be pretty effective in a tea form, too, would be thyme. And, you know, we use thyme in cooking. People use it. And partly the reason it was used in cooking was to kill off bacteria and viruses and stuff, especially bacteria in meat. And it seems to be pretty effective using it short-term, and you can use it in a tea. You know, you can combine it with, you said, elderberry. Echinacea, which is a great herb and is overused, I think, doesn't seem to really be that strong against this latest flu. But thyme and certainly elderberry, it seems to be effective. And we have another herb that we have called lomatium, which is called desert parsley, but it's not actually a desert plant, interestingly enough. It kind of grows in the Northwest. That's another one that maybe a little more difficult to find, but one that you can use is actually oregano. And I know a lot of people are using oil of oregano, which is the essential oil. I would advise people to be very careful with that essential oil and not to be taking it internally. But it can be used externally, diluted on the skin and on the glands. It will actually work really well to kill off bacteria in the glands. And another herb is holy basil, which seems to work fairly well against this virus, too. You can use holy basil in a tea. It's an Osinum plant, Osinum sanctum. It's a different type of basil than culinary basils, but it's in the same family, and it has a lot of antiviral and some antifungal properties to it, and that would be a good one in a tea. And it's kind of gotten a lot of attention over the last few years. It's used traditionally in India, and there are many. There are different types of Osinum that have been used for medicine for centuries, thousands of years. But that's another good one. And even a culinary basil that you use in cooking would still be effective, like using garlic when you're sick. Another great one that would be antiviral as well as antibacterial too.
It's funny. I have a vase on my kitchen table, and it has probably about 30 big chunks of garlic that are in there like all the time, and I just go through that and my daughter's, she'll just sit down and peel it and just chop it up and put 4 or 5 of them in her whatever she's eating. It's just so common, yet other people are so, you know, turned off by it that they just totally go away from it. So it's hard to get people to want to be able to take a botanical medicine when they think that it smells funny, it tastes funny, or whatever. And it's really great now that we're able to put them in these capsules, these extracts, but also you could have it freeze-dried too. So there are different avenues to be able to get a botanical if you do not like the taste or the smell.
Right, and that's interesting about garlic, that the Allium family, their Allium sativa garlic, it does actually hold up, according to the studies, in lots of different forms, which that's not always true with all of the botanicals we're talking about, but garlic does. So certainly garlic salt with lots of salt, you know, you're putting on your French fries or something, is probably not going to have the medicinal value that a clove of garlic would have. So I'm not insinuating
right.
that that's how you should take it. But garlic powder that you know is fairly good source and has the quality to it, still has the Allium effect. It still does help with your immune system. And so certainly the capsules you're talking about, gel caps and otherwise, are a great way to get that in. Obviously, the best way, you know, is to use the fresh or to use it in a stew or something like that. But certainly there are other ways to use it that you can get it into your diet to help with illness. And it's amazing to me, always when I try to remind myself about that, as well as my patients, you know, and they'll rediscover something like that, like starting to throw a clove of garlic in their food, or doing wet sock treatment on their feet when they have a headache or whatever it is, and they'll just say, "Wow, that really worked. That's really amazing," you know. And it seems like such a simple thing, you know, that we've forgotten. That's part of folk medicine and tradition, and it does really work. And we really need to re-remind ourselves of these things so that we can start to take care of ourselves and really become healthy again in a pretty unhealthy environment, too.
Especially when drugs and the environment are changing so much, you know. We're having a more toxic environment, so things are really not working as well anymore. So, Dr. Kim, it was really great having you with us today. We have about 1 minute left. If you can have a closing comment, that would be great.
Well, I really enjoyed speaking to everyone today, and you as well. And I encourage people to learn about a new herb each month. You know, if they're interested in herbal medicine, just look one up. Look into something and try to bring it into your diet. If it's a simple thing, you can make a tea out of it, you know, whether it's chamomile or something that's just supposed to help with longevity. We've got a lot of herbs like that, rhodochrome, herbs that will help your immune system, things that aren't toxic that you could learn about or put in your garden, grow some basil, you know, in your windowsill in your house, you know.
Right.
And not only use that fresh basil, it's a very different experience than, like you're saying, getting it in something pre-made. You know, you'll get some medicinal action. It'll probably make you feel a lot better. So I look forward to helping encourage people to re-educate themselves on this knowledge that we've had for centuries, for millennia, and we're just forgetting about, because we need it for our own health and the planet needs it too.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a pleasure having you on.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. If you'd like more information about Dr. Kim, her website link is located on today's show page. And she does have a contact us page where you can just send her a little note. If you'd like to speak to her or send her an email, you can do that through her website. It was a pleasure having everyone with us today. We have been talking about botanical medicine. And, you know, as we go forward with this new healthcare and a lot of these drugs that are starting to not work these days, Lord knows where we're going to be, but, you know, we need to start looking into botanicals. So pick out, like Dr. Kim said, one plant a month. By the end of the year, you may have 12 botanicals that you'll be able to start using and taking care of your own health. So thank you so much for being with us today. It's a pleasure. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and have a great day.